Welcome to the Brain Health Mission podcast, exploring how science, policy, and everyday choices shape the health of your brain and what you can do to protect it.
Welcome to the first episode of the Brain Health Mission podcast, the podcast where we explore the science and the stories behind the most powerful and vital organs in your body, your brain. I'm your host, Jana Middelfart-Hoff. I'm a consultant and professor of neurology in Bergen in Norway. And today we are kicking off with a topic that affects every single one of us, namely brain health. I'm joined here today by two great colleagues, Professor Paul Boone and Professor Barbara Cassola. Welcome to the both of you.
Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you very much, Jana, for the kind introduction.
Good morning to both of you. And if we go for the ladies first, who are you, Barbara?
Well, once again, thank you for the invitation to this podcast. I'm excited to be here with you today. My name is Barbara Cassola. I'm a full professor of neurology at Nice University Hospital in the southern part of France. I work with patients suffering from stroke from clinical and research point of view with a specific focus on severe stroke. And I am the co-chair for the European Academy of Neurology Brain Health Mission and a European Stroke Organization representative within this mission.
And the second guest is you. Paul, who are you? A few words to your background.
Once more, Jana, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to joining together with Barbara. My name is Paul Boone. I'm a neurologist, professor of neurology at Ghent University and at Eindhoven University of Technology in the Netherlands. I'm basically a clinician, but I also run an experimental lab. My focus is on epilepsy and disorders of consciousness. And I have served in many positions at the European Academy of Neurology. I'm currently the past president and the co-chair of the Brain Health Mission.
So in this episode, we definitely have two of Europe's top neurologists and brain scientists trying to unveil the mystery of brain health together with me. For what exactly is brain health? Is it just about avoiding disease, or is there more to it? We will try to unpack what brain health really is today and why it is essential, not only for us as individuals, but also for the society and also what you can do to protect and enhance it. But first, we need a definition. Barbara, do you have a clear and precise definition of what brain health actually is?
Well, actually, Jana, we start strong. We start hard. I have to say that I don't know the answer probably, and I'm not sure that there is a clear definition for brain health, or maybe very likely there are many definitions. But as a neurologist, I would define brain health as the optimal functioning of all the brain functions and regions, encompassing motor, function, all the sensory functions, language and communication, coordination also, cognitive function, and emotional regulation. This is a comprehensive definition that ensures that the brain operates at its best, enabling each individual to reach its full potential and live a productive and healthy life.
I think that was very good. Barbara, anything you would like to add, Paul?
Well, I think Barbara gave a very eloquent account of what brain health actually is. The point is that I think we most of us do understand in general terms what brain health means, while we still lack a universally accepted definition. And for reasons of, well, convergence, EAN and many other stakeholders are currently using the WHO definition, which is an operational definition open for some interpretation. But basically, it is what is sure, I think, is that we should look at the holistic definition of brain health being more than the absence of brain disease, and basically allowing or providing all the faculties to a human being of exerting all the functions that are needed to life or to live a normal life and to cope with normal life situations. That would be my best guess in a holistic sense.
I like the holistic approach because you and I've discussed this before, Paul, but when we talk about brain health, many people automatically think about mental health. But mental health is only one aspect of it, isn't it? Especially for us neurologists. But the brain health issue is more than just mental health.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And there certainly is still an ongoing and sometimes intense debate on what exactly the relation between mental health and brain health on the one hand and neurological health and mental health on the other hand is. I mean, this is an interesting intellectual discussion, but basically, if we really look at it on a somewhat higher level of abstraction, psychiatric disorders are on the one hand brain-related, on the other hand, society-related. And that's, I guess, where the confusion or the debate comes from, while neurological disorders typically are somatically defined disorders. So if you translate that to brain health, I would say, if you really look at it clearly, that what is society? Society is defined by the common perception of a large number of individuals. And what is that perception based on? On the brains of that group of individuals. So honestly, I mean, I think the debate is intellectually interesting and stimulating, but we might not get to a consensus ever. So what I would say is, and the way I look at it, is that mental health, neurological health are two sides of the same coin. And the coin is to be taken literally because it has also to do with capital, with potential.
I think that's a very good way of saying it, that brain health should be all-inclusive. That means inclusive mental health and not excluding anything, because the brain is actually who we are, wouldn't you say, Paul?
It is the organ that defines the personality, that defines, in fact, and ultimately who we are. I think if there is any difference between two equal people, it is the way their brains are wired.
In the brain health mission, we sometimes also have the feeling that brain health is forgotten or not mentioned when public health is on the agenda. There is a lot of discussion about public health, and then brain health is something very on the side. Do you think the same as me there, Barbara? Do you also have that impression?
Well, you're totally right from my side, Jana. I think that considering the proportion of the problem, which is huge, when you think that conditions affecting the nervous system were collectively ranked as leading causes of disability in the world, affecting about 3.4 billion, if I'm not wrong, individuals, I would definitely say that brain health is often overlooked in public health discussions, despite, as we said, its significance in the overall health and well-being, and I would say also for the society, the well-being of the society. So this is one of the missions of the Brain Health Missions, advocating for greater awareness and attention to brain health, putting in place effective prevention, treatment, and even, I would say, rehabilitation strategies for disorders affecting the nervous system, and probably going back to the previous discussion also to the psychiatric and mental health problem, because they are definitely two sides, as Paul said, of the same coin.
We talked about what brain health is, but we need to tell people why it is so important, because the brain is actually only 2% of your body weight, but uses 20% of the energy you consume. So at least your body thinks it's important, and it controls everything, your thoughts and emotions, movements, and even your immune system. So when we talk about brain health, we are really talking about how we live. And Barbara and Paul, what would you say poses the most common threats to brain health today? And can brain health if it is affected, also influence negatively the way we live, interact with others, work, and so on. Do you have any reflections on that?
Well, I would say, Jana, that the brain is also made up of vessels. And probably from my point of view, there is very likely a bias because I'm a vascular neurologist, but cerebrovascular risk factors, including smoking, excessive alcohol consumption, arterial hypertension, diabetes, dyslipidemia, lack of physical exercise, basically our lifestyle mostly are, from my point of view, the most important modifiable risk factors for brain health. Actually, pollution is becoming also increasingly important, together with an increase of toxic substances abuse among young generations. So very likely by modifying lifestyle, screening actively and treating these factors, the risk of some neurological disorders, including stroke, cognitive disorders, but also many others, can be reduced up by 80%. So prevention is essential. And concerning the the impact of brain health functioning on the way we live, of course, and coming back to the very first question, I would say that it would be very interesting to ask our patients their definition of brain health, because of course, lives are definitely impacted deeply by a normal and physiological brain functioning.
Now, that patient aspect is very important. That's true, Barbara. Paul?
Well, I think Barbara already mentioned very rightfully so and eloquently the importance of preventing on cardiovascular risk side. Those risk factors are well known, and we are basically deeply indebted to the cardiologists and the vascular colleagues of providing us these insights, and they're well known and evidence-based. Apart from everything that has been said, and in terms of risk factors, what I would add is what we really need, in addition to observing known preventive factors, cardiovascular factors, is more specific brain-derived risk factors. Risk factors that we commonly do not understand very well or do not know yet, or that are maybe suspected but not really evidence-based. So the true progress is on both sides. It is on, well, make sure that everybody understands the cardiovascular risk factors and tries to avoid them. And secondly, that we actively promote research into more brain-specific risk factors, which I, and more concretely, what I mean is trying to find or try, well, certainly stimulate research into specific biomarkers that could predict brain disorders, that could predict neurological disorders, that could also allow establishing prognosis of known brain disorders. So this is really what we, I believe, need. Apart from the factors that Barbara mentioned, I would like to do two additions. Healthy sleep is a very important one. We tend to forget that we spend about one third of our life being unconscious in our bed, with the prospect or the expectation of sleeping and recovering. Basically, what we do during sleep is reloading, rebooting our central computer, both in physical terms and psychological terms. So the importance of observing good sleep hygiene, I believe, is essential. And secondly, the link with mental well-being is extremely important. So creating an environment, both at home in your personal life, but also in your professional life, that is brain healthy, that promotes well-being, and at the same time, not by just pampering the workforce, but by also promoting resilience, I believe is key. So if we want to promote and improve brain health, observing the risk factors that we know, looking for new risk factors that we still don't know, and then also look at things that we take for granted, but that are essential in preserving our brain health, namely sleep.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, isn't it, how it's all tangled together? Because we know that also social interaction is important to keep your brain healthy. If you are deprived of sleep, you are very sleepy and tired, then you're not in the mood to interact with others around you. Then you get less social contact. hypertension is linked with bad sleep, and so on and so forth. Barbara, if somebody who's listening to this podcast are wondering, are there signs, preferably early, that someone's brain health may be at risk? Are there signs which should make you think about altering your lifestyle, see somebody you think?
I'm curious about what Paul will say about that, but brain has a very high capacity of compensation, and a disease can progress for years before manifesting itself. So basically, from my experience, signs of dysfunction of the brain in general often manifest themselves when the damage is already there. From a neurological point of view, we have a very strong basis to say that we should act at a very young age to preserve brain health through prevention. And concerning biomarkers Paul was talking about, we are really looking forward to have them, because for most of the diseases, well, in the field of stroke, it's even more visible, we do not have them. So we can act by acting on the vascular risk factors, but basically there are some diseases that are that appear when they are just already there, I would say.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a good point of view. Anything to add to that, Paul?
We know that Parkinson's disease is maybe starting elsewhere, so not in the brain, but maybe in the abdominal, in the gut system, many, many years, maybe a decade before the first clinical symptoms of motor symptoms are visible. Probably the same for Alzheimer's disease, where many patients already experience small issues or even in the pre-symptomatic timing, there may already be things happening in the brain. So while we have made quite some progress in the biomarker business in neurodegenerative disease, I believe there's still a lot to be done. Now, let's not be completely blind for or focus completely on primary prevention. The other point that I wanted to make, Jana, is that if we would also make progress, and this is actually happening now, in delaying the onset of neurological disorders and neurodegenerative disorders. And just imagine that we would be able to delay the onset of Parkinson and dementia with 10 years or 15 years. Many people would not experience the disease because they might have died already, or they might have reached an age beyond their life expectancy, which would also make a tremendous difference in terms of public health. So we should at the same time be very revolutionary and groundbreaking in our thoughts. We should put our capital and our expectation into new findings, revolutionary findings, at the same time pursuing the paths that you are currently pursuing, leading to possible delay in onset of neurological disorders.
I think that's so cool that we shouldn't forget secondary prevention or delaying when talking about primary prevention and prognostic markers and so on, because you as an experienced epileptologist know that, Paul, that when you have young patients, for instance, who had a stable epilepsy through their childhood, and then they start getting teenagers and they start partying and do not sleep as much as they should, then suddenly they get their seizures back. I've been working with those for many years, and so you see how a regular lifestyle is also good if you have a neurological disease, in order to make it as little chronic for you as possible. So that's cool. We are aging. We wouldn't like to think about that. We think about maturing, but the population in the world is going to be older than any of our ancestors, probably. And this also affects the brain. The brain is also aging. What happens actually to the brain when it ages? And must it get worse, or are there things that are gained as well, or strategies that we could employ not to avoid aging, because to get older is also a better alternative than not to get older, but in order to cope or in order to compensate for the things that might be negative and happening. Do you have any ideas on that, Paul or Barbara?
Can I be very blunt in just making a statement here?
Be blunt.
Normal brain aging does not make you dumber. It does not necessarily affect the main cognitive functions. The only thing it may do is make some processes a bit slower. So the statement would be, getting old doesn't make you dumber, maybe a bit slower, but that's it. So the misperception in older populations that forgetting to a level that is annoying or that is interfering with daily life is normal, that is a misunderstanding. That is not normal. That is not true. I mean, normal aging in a healthy elderly person does not involve major issues with brain function. And it obviously all depends on a way of, you know, on the genes that you have and on the genetic background. And certainly the other half probably is determined by lifestyle and environment. But the misperception that I think we should fight is that it is normal to become forgetful and to become, forgetful or to have cognitive issues that interfere with daily life, that this is a normal feature. I think that is a misunderstanding that we should get out of this world.
I like that message very much. Older, not dumber. Barbara, anything you would like to say before we take some fun facts about the brain?
Well, I totally agree with Paul and with you, Jana. And to strengthen the concept, I would say that in my clinical practice, I actively promote the concept that age is not an absolute variable. And what really matters is the physiological age more than the registry date of birth. It is, of course, something we cannot modify, but actually, we do see older adults that have a very well-preserved brain from a clinical and radiological point of view, despite their age. So very likely, coming back to our previous conversation, social engagement and mental and physical exercise definitely is something we can do to keep our brain trained and maintain the cognitive abilities Paul was talking about.
Keep active. That's a good slogan. The brain is interesting and it's also very much fun. And it actually, if you would put it on to some electric current, it generates enough electricity to power a light bulb. That's actually quite cool, I think. And it also has more cells in it than there are stars in the Milky Way. Quite hard to grasp. But there are facts and then there are myths. And what are the weirdest brain myths you've heard, Barbara and Paul? Barbara first.
Well, one weird brain myth is that humans only use 10% of their brain. This has been debunked by experts in neuroscience, because in reality, when we do brain imaging techniques like functional imaging, we have shown that different areas of the brain are actually active at different times. And even the parts of the brain that are supposedly inactive are still performing important background functions. So the brain is a very complex and highly active organ. And the message is probably a little bit different, is that a damage to even a very small area can have significant effects on cognition and behavior and all the other functions we mentioned.
That's true. The body wouldn't allow us to have a brain that we only used 10% of and to carry it around. I think so too. That's a very good point. And Paul, what is the weirdest myth you've ever heard?
There's so many brain myth, and in a way, a myth can bear some truth. A myth can be completely a reflection of a complete mistake. I, as a matter of fact, I just mentioned one, that is that normal aging is associated with forgetfulness and things that interfere negatively with daily life. One of the things that I like to discuss is, a lot of information in lay press, typically in magazines, on sleep and dreaming. That is like a huge resource for myths, things that are completely not evidence-based. And I would like to grasp this question to raise one point, one concern. That while the knowledge on brain health and brain disorders is exploding, it is growing exponentially. It's a big challenge to keep yourself informed of what is happening, not only in your own field but in parallel or neighboring fields. I think what is essential is that our community also provides honest and correct information to the lay community about what brain functions really mean, what the true mechanism of action of new therapies is. I think we really have to fight fake news on brain and brain knowledge and brain science. There is really a lot of misinformation on the internet and on social media, and I believe that is where the neurological community and the brain health mission community should participate actively to improve this.
I agree with you, Paul, definitely. Before we're moving on to giving the listeners tools or suggestions on what they can do to take care of their own brain health, I would like to know if you could download one skill into your brain instantly. What would that be, Barbara? What would you like to do from one moment to another or know or master?
Well, Jana, one of my favorite functions of the brain is communication. So I got inspired by you, and I would love to speak perfectly all the languages of the world as a mother tongue. So being able to communicate naturally with all the potential patients or people of the world.
And that would be great, wouldn't it? Just to wake up and then you commanded all the languages you needed and even some.
Right.
Without all the stressing and the learning. And,
right.
Yeah. And you, Paul, what would you like to master?
Well, you know, my favorite overnight download would be the faculty of playing piano faultlessly. I love music. I have learned to play piano, but I'm not very well talented. I'm not actually not talented at all. And I mean, if I look at concert pianists on an international level and I see them play on stage, the first thing that I think is, wow, I would love to see these brains under a scan and see exactly what's happening and what the processing of all the different networks that are involved in producing this wonderful music and interpreting this beautiful music is. This is a faculty that I would love to have and I don't have. So that if you are, I was thinking about the question while you were asking it, that would be my favorite download.
Yeah. I agree with both of you, and it's the human dream, isn't it? Just to do something and to master something without having to practice at all. And unfortunately, it's not like that. Some of us are more gifted, but also top pianists need to practice. But yeah, language. I'm also a very bad car driver, so I thought that would be nice too, without the practicing. But if we move back to more serious matters, to those who are listening to us, can we give them any tools? What can they do to take care of their brains? Are there anything that you would like to emphasize?
Well, I think referring to, and we're getting a bit more serious now, I would refer to the evidence that is proven. So the list, and I will not repeat it completely, but it's all about exercise, physical and mental exercise. It's about social interaction. It is about diet. We did not cover that very well, but a brain healthy diet is certainly a concept that is existing. There's quite some debate on that, but Avoiding cardiovascular risk factors that are dietary-related, observing enough and quality, high-quality sleep, and making sure that you live your personal and professional life in a brain-healthy environment. These are basically, that is what we can do on an individual level, and each individual who's consciousness about this should just see how these general recommendations can be applied in this in your personal life, basically. That would be my recommendation, and I just take the opportunity to our professional audience to refer again to the or to look and read and maybe disseminate also the publications that we have made on this. There is a roadmap on brain health that has been published by the EAN. We will make quite some publicity on this during the Congress. There's lots of things happening in brain health. For the interested audience and informed audience, I would just warmly recommend reading the documents that we have produced recently.
Yeah, and I agree, and especially the brain map is cool. It's easy to understand. There are concrete things you can do. There are tools both for you as a personal and also to recommend and also try to advocate in your society. But Barbara, do you have any a few things that you would like the listeners to focus on?
I think that Paul said, I would say all of them. One thing which can be seen as a positive point is that concerning the physical exercise, even 15 minutes a day can make the difference. So it is not a matter of running the marathon, but I think that a very daily exercise can really impact. And I was also thinking back to our funny question, because I wanted to download the idea of having all the languages of the world in my brain installed, but basically probably exercising my brain by learning them would be a better option to have a good brain health in the future.
That's true. Even though it's more exhaustive, it's better right. For your brain than to sort of learn it in an instant. To say less is more is sometimes important. That goes for physical activity. It doesn't need to be 100%. Just to do it on a regular basis as well. The same goes for sleeping. It's not bad to have one bad night before an exam or before an important thing at work. But it's what you do in the whole year that matters, not the one day or the two. So I think that's good. But then we need to get some personal things out of you as well. What do you then, Barbara and Paul, do? Are there any brain health habits you have started recently that you could share with our listeners? Paul?
Well, I've been, given also my the stage of my life and age where I'm in, I'm being more observant about what I eat and drink, which means I enjoy once in a while a good glass of wine, but I'm very moderate and become more moderate in recent years, and just observing some dietary measures, avoiding some kinds of food. Still, often the foods that one likes most are often the least healthy, so there is a compromise to be made there. And the other thing is just that, and I'm helped by my professional environment. I work in a big hospital, so I run around a lot. So I have no issues with getting my 10,000 steps or whatever number of steps that you need to be physically fit. So those are the simple measures that I have been observing in recent years, and more strictly, more recently. So just exercise and diet. That's really key to my personal strategy.
Mm. Very good suggestions. Barbara, what about you?
Well, Jana, I would say that doctors are very bad at having a good lifestyle. So, yes, recently I started to try to practice 10 minutes of yoga before my coffee when I wake up daily. And this is also a way, I would say, to say to myself that I am taking care of me. And it starts very early in the morning. So this is the best I can do for now.
And I think you do it very wisely, Barbara, because what you do is that you do the yoga and then you say, before my coffee. And that is something that the brain is very prone to, that you are rewarding it. You are saying, if I do the yoga now, then I get the coffee afterwards. And that the nudging thing is something we are need to discuss more. Thank you for sharing. And a good news for the listeners that the themes that we've dipped a little bit into now, the tools that you can use to enhance your brain health or to protect your brain, will be more focused on in later episodes of this podcast. So we will go into a deep dive into diet and physical activity. But for now, we know what Paul and Barbara are up to when they are taking care of their brain. I think we are coming to an end of this episode. And to wrap it all up, there are things that you as an individual can do. But brain health isn't just a personal issue, it's a public one. As our population ages, the burden of brain-related conditions like dementia and depression is growing, and investing in brain health means investing in our future, our productivity, our relationship, and also our well-being as society. Do you have any final remarks to those who have listened to us, Barbara and Paul? Barbara first?
Well, I think that maybe they can just think about the definition of brain health and think for their point of view of what they can do in their life to try to improve it in the future. Starting from now, this is the idea, not postpone this question, which is very urgent and important for all of us.
Paul, last?
Well, just a few comments. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to share some general and personal thoughts. I appreciated it very much. From the European Academy of Neurology side, two events that I would like to briefly announce. First of all, during our Congress, the 23rd of June, so next week, we will have the first Public Brain Health Day, which will be specifically oriented towards the lay public in Helsinki in Finland. But we envisage to expand that initiative during each Congress, addressing the local population. So this event will be in Finnish and directed to Finnish lay public. Secondly, and directly relevant to the topic here of defining brain health in a more practical way, in a more generally accepted way, I'm just announcing that on the 22nd of July, which is World Brain Day, EAN will launch a massive campaign on providing information and asking the contribution of a large group of people using social media on helping us to define brain health in a more operational way. More news is going to follow soon.
Super. And that shows that not only is it happening in the brain, but also about the brain. And that is good. Thank you for tuning in to the Brain Health Mission podcast. Thanks to my super guests, neurologists and brain scientists, Barbara Cassola and Paul Boone. My name is Jana Middelfart-Hoff. I hope you enjoyed our first episode, more out to follow. If you did, why don't you share it with a friend and subscribe for more conversations that could keep your mind sharp and be a part of your brain health protection.
Thank you very much, Jana.
Thank you very much, Jana. Thank you, Barbara.
You've been listening to the Brain Health Mission podcast, where science meets action for a healthier brain. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to follow us on Spotify or your favorite podcast app so you never miss an update. For more tools, tips, and expert insights, head to brainhealthmission.org. That's brainhealthmission.org. A special thank you to our supporting partner, Roche, for supporting our mission. Until next time, take care of your brain. It's the only one you've got.